Good morning. Today is Monday, the 8th of September. My name is Chris Hotting, and this is the latest risk alert from the Center for Risk Analysis. This is a service for CRA subscribers brought to you every Monday morning at 7 a.m. sharp by the CRA, helping you make better decisions. In this week's risk alert, we begin with South Africans dissipating hopes for the GNU. Next, the ANC's provincial struggles and the battle for the party's soul. Thereafter, we examine the impact of ArcelorMittal South Africa's Newcastle plant closure, and we close with a look at the latest Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit, a Chinese military parade, and implications for global trade and alliances. As mentioned in last week's risk alert, the Government of National Unity's sugar high has run out. South Africans' high initial expectations of growth and reform are steadily receding. The latest study by Ipsos, What Worries the World, finds that 8 out of 10 South Africans surveyed feel the country is on the wrong track, compared with a global average of 63%. Just 20% of South Africans feel the country is going in the right direction, a number that registered as high as 40% between July and September of last year, immediately after the formation of the GNU. A separate report by Ipsos finds that 42% of South Africans believe the GNU parties are working together very or fairly well, while 40% believe the GNU has changed nothing in South Africa. Despite increased unmet GNU expectations, 54% of voting-age South Africans believe different political parties should work together at local government level. The idea of cross-party collaboration remains popular, but the way the GNU is doing it, increasingly less so. In a further sign of ANC decline, the party's chairperson in the Eastern Cape, Mr. Oscar Mabuyane, noted at an election strategy meeting last week that about 300 of approximately 710 branches in the province were not in good standing. Unless this is rectified, it could affect the legitimacy of regional and provincial elective conferences, and ultimately the ANC's national elective conference in December 2027. Mr. Mabuyane also reported that the number of party members in the province had dipped below 100,000, while lamenting the state of the membership system. In the ANC's 2024 annual report, the Eastern Cape's number of ANC members in good standing was reported as being 101,285 as of December of last year. However, a different part of the same report states the membership in good standing as being 55,459, underscoring concerns about the validity of membership numbers. In its provincial report on the Eastern Cape, the party's annual report notes, quote, "diminishing public confidence in the ANC and the political system, warns that traditional supporters of the National Democratic Revolution are disengaging, and argues that rising discontent is exacerbated by economic stagnation, escalating violence, and internal factional vulnerabilities," end quote. All these charges can be laid at the door of the national ANC as well. That they are this pronounced in the Eastern Cape, a traditional ANC stronghold where the party obtained its second highest provincial result in last year's election, where it has the third highest number of members, and which is the ancestral home of ANC icons such as Nelson Mandela, Thabo Mbeki, Walter Sisulu and Oliver Tambo, will set the alarm bells ringing. Accordingly, Mr. Mabuyane is quoted as saying, "We're fighting for the soul of the ANC, for the survival of the movement, and the transformation of South Africa." End quote. ArcelorMittal South Africa, the country's only integrated steelmaker, has confirmed it will close its Newcastle long steel operations, shedding 3,500 jobs and halving its steelmaking capacity. The move follows years of declining output and failed state attempts to keep the plant afloat. The government has already channeled nearly 2 billion rand into Newcastle, including wage support, but with little effect. A buyer is being sought, though similar efforts came to naught when AMSA closed its Saldanha facility in 2020. The underlying problem is global oversupply. World production outstrips demand by around 70 million tons annually. South Africa's crude steel output fell 32% between 2014 and 2023, while local demand has been hit by stagnant investment and a moribund construction sector. Pretoria has sought to shield AMSA through tariffs, blaming cheap Chinese imports. The policy has backfired, raising costs for hundreds of smaller steel fabricators that rely on affordable inputs and collectively support far more jobs than AMSA itself. With Newcastle gone, South Africa will produce about 4.7 million tons of steel annually, placing it alongside mid-tier producers such as the United Kingdom and the United Arab Emirates. While some insist on the strategic value of domestic production, analysts note Newcastle produces nothing that cannot be sourced more cheaply from abroad. Industry insiders suggest the shutdown could open the way for tariff reductions, lowering costs for downstream firms. But logistical bottlenecks loom. Rail is in disrepair, ports are under strain, and more freight will likely shift to already congested highways. One sector unaffected is defense. Local ballistic steel comes entirely from imports, with the industry making little use of UMSA's products. However, for non-defense fabricators, cheaper imports could improve competitiveness, much as the UAE built its construction boom almost entirely on imported steel. The immediate pain will fall on UMSA's workforce. The wider economy could benefit from imports and competition if Pretoria is able to pivot from protecting legacy capacity to enabling growth across the industry. However, given the ANC's well-established preference for state intervention in the economy, this is unlikely to happen. Instead, the government is likely to continue doubling down on subsidies, regulations, and tariffs in a vain attempt to halt South Africa's progressive deindustrialization. The 25th summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or SCO, in Tianjin, China, produced pageantry that masked as much as it revealed. China, Russia, and India, three powers often at odds, took the opportunity to project a rare alignment. Chinese President Xi Jinping used the event to lend a sympathetic ear to world leaders who feel aggrieved by US President Donald Trump's harsh treatment, all the while looking for any opportunity to integrate their economies into Chinese manufacturing, export, and supply chains. Mr. Xi announced a raft of new initiatives, including a surprise proposal for an SCO development bank. While such an institution would signal a departure from the SCO's original security mandate, its prospects remain uncertain given members' long record of mutual distrust. In a carefully staged moment, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Russian President Vladimir Putin joined Mr. Xi in an informal huddle, smiling for cameras and speaking of multipolarity and shared interests. Each also held bilateral meetings. Mr. Xi and Mr. Modi described their countries as development partners, not rivals, while Mr. Putin and Mr. Xi reaffirmed their close personal ties. Both Modi and Putin likewise exchanged warm words about a quote-unquote shoulder-to-shoulder partnership. These gestures are designed to signal resilience in the face of mounting Western pressure, while cementing China's role as the leader of the aggrieved. With the US escalating tariffs on India, sustaining its trade war with China, and tightening sanctions on Russia, the SCO's leading members sought to present themselves as an alternative pole in world affairs. Mr. Putin went so far as to suggest the SCO could become the vanguard of a, quote, more just global governance system, end quote. Yet, for all the symbolism, the summit did not produce much substance. China and India remain deeply divided over their border dispute, and India is wary of any institution that looks like a Chinese financial arm. Despite the photo ops and flowery language, decades of deep-seated mutual distrust and conflict between these two aspiring global powers, engaged in dancing a quote-unquote dragon-elephant tango, as Chinese Vice President Han Zheng put it, are unlikely to be cured in the short term. And lastly, the SCO summit was followed by a victory parade held in Beijing on the 3rd of September. Marking the 80th anniversary of the, quote, Chinese People's War of Resistance Against Japanese Aggression and the World Anti-Fascist War, end quote, the parade showcased the latest in Chinese military hardware and was attended by the leaders of four nations that Washington describes as the so-called axis of upheaval, North Korea, Iran, Russia, and China itself. They were joined by a rogues gallery, including the president of Belarus, Mr. Alexander Lukashenko, the military leader of Myanmar, Senior General Min Aung Hlaing, the president of Cuba, Miguel Diaz-Canel, and the president of Zimbabwe, Emmerson Mnangagwa. In hosting the economic summit and military parade back-to-back, China aimed to display its influence in its soft and hard power capacities while demonstrating its acceptance of authoritarianism ranging to totalitarianism. For South African companies, the key risk is that deepening Sino-Russian-Indian alignment hardens the divide in global trade and finance. This could accelerate decoupling from Western systems, with ripple effects for market access, capital flows, and supply chains, not to mention democracy, human rights, and civil liberties. That is all from us for this week. We wish you a successful week ahead, and we'll be back with you next week, Monday morning at 7 a.m. sharp, with the latest risk alert.